was it who wrote that beautiful epitaph? It wasn't even an epitaph. It was carved on a guy's headstone. I can't remember who it was. Somebody famous. I'll have to invent a name. I think it is even carved on an actual headstone of a famous man. It says, "Here lies Jonathan Abernathy. He was undone by fools and knaves." Undone by fools and knaves. Get out of my way, you knave, fool, slob. Oh, boy. This guy was onto something serious. Yeah, go ahead and laugh, you fool. Slob. Do you realize you're laughing at a human being? Living protoplasm, I'm alive. Oh, shut it. Cut it out. The only thing the world knows how to do is laugh through its crummy nose. Adenoidal. He laugh. Yes. Shut up! Fools and knaves, clowns, idiots, boobs. Everywhere you look, there are so few of us real people. So few of us. Shut up, I said! So few of us. All of my life I've looked for real people. Once or twice in a whole year you'll run across a person that has maybe just the suggestion of real. Get up! Fools, knaves, bums, idiots, clowns. Yes, here lies Jonathan Abernathy, undone by fools and knaves. Have you ever had the feeling that you've been undone by fools and knaves? Of course. Boy, is that a modern headstone. Fools and knaves, for crying out. You know, as long as we're on the subject of fools and knaves, and by the way, that will be tonight's subject, so if you fit into either category, you might as well leave. Get down there with a... Go on, get out! I don't need you! Right out loud. I'm sustaining. I don't need you. Oh. Doggone sales department. Listen to him. Sitting on the back end of their yachts out there in Long Island Sound. Some of those guys have main pipelines that bring nothing but martinis all the way out from shore. Buy their olives by the crate. Sit there and twiddle their thumbs. Blow their flugelhorns. Play their hi-fi. Tickle their wives and other people. Yeah. Listen to that. Fools, knaves, clowns, idiots. All of you. We're wise to you. All those guys that are working a night shift, you're not fooling us. Boy, you're not kidding Long John, I'll tell you. He's pretending, I know. Go ahead and laugh, gambling. Go on. Go ahead and laugh, Martha Teen. Go on. Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Arlene Francis. Blow your trombone. You're not fooling any of us here on a night shift. Not a bit of a... Fools, knaves, idiots, clowns. Oh, boy. Listen to the nuts. Oh. Shut up. Get it out. Oh, what a terrible nightmare. All of them. John Gambling. Al McCann. With two cases of frozen asparagus for security. Dora McCann, all of them sitting out there in the darkness laughing. Oh. You can't beat them. And you know, it's not true. You can't join them either. You just can't join them. Because they can tell when you're real, you know, Ed? Believe me, I don't fool Al McCann for a second. I try to talk to him about gravy, you know, and big buys and ham. I talk to him about roast lamb. It doesn't even get... He knows. He can tell. There's a look in the eye. He knows. You know, I'll tell you, I'm beginning to believe that there really, there genuinely are two phases of the world, of our time. There are the people who are living within themselves the true totalitarian existence. A lot of kinds of totalitarianism, you know. Oh, boy. Oh, no, really, really, I wonder how many of us do feel as though we've been undone by fools and knaves. And do the fools and knaves believe that the other side are the fools and knaves? Of course. It's just absolutely true. There's no question about it. But right down the middle, the night shift and the day shift here. Two separate worlds. Two separate and complete worlds. They look at you funny through the glass. I can't tell whether they're pale or whether they're tan. Well, they're pale inside, but they're tan outside. You know, from walking around with all that money in their pockets and that look of seniority about them. You know what I mean? It's a funny business, you know? I wonder how many people have ever had the experience of living in a totalitarian world. A totalitarian world of fiat, of rule, of law, of book. Now, most guys, in a way, work in a totalitarian world, but they can escape it at night. You know, they get away from it, and they go home, and then they live usually in another kind of totalitarian world that decrees that they can't wear Bermuda shorts, or they can wear, or they have to wear Bermuda shorts. Well, you know, the one or the other, you can't wear a derby hat in the neighborhood. It just people laugh you right out of there. Of course, that's another kind of totalitarianism. That is the totalitarianism by, let us say, mutual consent. It's like this friend of mine who lived for a while in a section in London. No, it was Scotland, actually. It was in Scotland at that time, in Edinburgh. And he was teaching school there. And he said, you know, we here in America always are talking about conformity. That's a big deal in America. And we like to think that other countries don't have it. For some reason or other, we feel that the Irish don't have conformity, that they're all individualists, you know. Sure, it didn't be God. The uprising. Yeah, we like to believe that. Because, of course, we don't know the mores of the neighborhood. We just don't know them well enough to recognize the totalitarianism. Again, this is the kind of by mutual consent. There's two kinds. There's the mutual consent totalitarianism, and then there's the totalitarianism of government fiat, which is the kind, you know, that is usually the dictatorship. You know, that's a political totalitarianism. But he was living in Edinburgh, and he was telling me about the family that he lived with. He was boarding in this family. And the guy was a working man. He was a regular, ordinary, working-type Scotsman. And he worked in the car barns or something like that. And every night, this guy would go to the Dugs. They're insane about dog racing in Scotland. Did you know that? That was a big deal there. Oh, yes. The poorer class, all the way on up and down. The different classes in different countries have different sports, as it is true here in this country up to a certain point. To give you an example of that, in London, the middle class, the lower class people follow football matches. Football matches, people going around kicking each other and very, very basic sports. There's hardly any subtlety to the kind of football they play there. It has nothing to do with the New York Giants at all. Just a bunch of guys kicking each other and trying to get the ball into the net. By sheer force, that's all. There's a guy bouncing it off their head. This is a basic sport over there. On the other end of the scale, you have the center court at Wimbledon. Very, very different. Very different. The mores, the attitudes, the sound of a tennis match in the very high echelon of society sounds like no sporting event you've ever been to. Have you ever been to one, Ed? It's a very peculiar, muted quality. There's almost a sense of put down, as though they're putting down what they're watching. Oh yes, it's very intriguing. Very good. And then they'll sit and they'll turn to each other and ignore it, as though their show of passion about that beautiful forehand smash, that show of passion, was just a little too much, and they must turn and then show the player that They were just applauding the play, not him, because he came from a very low class whose father, his father was a shoe salesman. So very, very, very good, very good, very good. Then they'll turn to each other and go back to the Manhattan, iced and cooled. And I've had a couple of occasions. I remember one time, the first time I ever ran into that was very nutty. This is an Army story. In case you're interested in an Army story, I'll tell you an Army story to end all peculiar Army stories of how, I think one of the things that the Army has done and did do for millions of guys was to introduce them to another form of life other than the one they were accustomed to. In fact, two forms of life. One, it introduces them to the totalitarian world of fiat. Boy, any guy who's ever been in the Army has a secret knowledge of what it's like to live under totalitarianism, Ed. Absolutely. He knows this. On the other hand, he has, by the fact that the Army sent him all over the world, usually has learned about other places that he would never have learned about had he stayed in Hammond, Indiana. Speaking of totalitarianism, this is WOR-AM and FM New York. And we have with us tonight the Mandarin House people there. And Sinister Orientals, by the way. And if you are if you're interested at all in food, and certainly since this is a sybaritic society we're living in, there is hardly a man jack of you that isn't interested in some kind of a passionate, wild experience, I would like to suggest, as a passionate, wild experience, a visit to Mandarin East on 2nd Avenue, just north of 57th Street. Oh, the heady, the lights, the insensate pleasures, the pleasures that can render you into a chaotic mass of conflicting passions. A night at the groaning board of Mandarin East. Just put yourself in their hands. They will darken the lights, and you will slowly decline as those great purple clouds of passion move through your... Oh, wow, you talk about opium. This is Mandarin East on 2nd Avenue, just north of 57. They got a great bar, and the food is superbly, right? Okay. Well, anyway, I'm in the Army, you see, and I'm remember, I am from a steel mill town. And almost everybody I knew, it was just a natural thing for kids in my world, and I'm talking about high school kids, not just little kids. It was a very natural thing because it was a physical world we lived in. The world of the intellect had very little, well, in fact, it was practically unknown, as far as I know, in this section of northern Indiana and south Chicago. It was purely a physical world where they made gigantic steel plates. The whole population was devoted to going to work on the night shift and coming home and wrestling with tin and keeping the open hearth going, and always those red skies were flowing, and this was all a world of action, purely a world of action. Trains roaring through. Do you know that more trains go through the south part of Chicago than any other major city in the United States? Oh yes, it's because of the geographical location of Chicago. Chicago is like, if you look at the map, you will find that all major railroads meet in Chicago. They do not all come to New York. They do not all come to Philadelphia. It's like Chicago is the hub of all the railroads. Yes, at one time, you know, it was the Great Lakes Shipping Center, and still is, of course. It was the meat packing center. It was the steel center. Everything that anybody made any place else in the country and a lot of places in the world had to come from Chicago, pure and simple. The ore, the great iron ore boats that would come down through the Great Lakes would all unload in Chicago. They'd come down from Minneapolis. And even if the stuff was going to get sent to Pittsburgh, it would start out in Chicago and go by rail or something to Pittsburgh or by boat and so on. But very, very, it is a wild place for trains and for great action machines. And so when you grow up in a city where, you know, that East Chicago, Indiana, now to give you an idea of what a strangely chaotic place this is, East Chicago, Indiana, which is really a part of Chicago, but it's in Indiana, as you can tell by the name, East Chicago, Indiana, the main street, and this is a big town, it's not really a town, it's a city yet, the main street has running right down the center of it, right directly down the center of it, a gigantic railroad track. Now, I'm not talking about a streetcar track. I'm talking about freight trains running right down in front of the dime store. If you can imagine a train running right down the middle of Fifth Avenue. Now, I mean a real train with coal cars and with cows howling, with great big coal cabooses and iron smoke and so on. And these trains go right down the middle of the street. No rails on either side of them. And you can drive your car right next to this freight train that's going. They used to kill about what? Yeah, well, Passaic has that. Do they really? Right down parallel down the main street. Well, Passaic, New Jersey, then, is the only one I've heard of. I didn't know that. No, not in East Chicago. They couldn't, because if they were to eliminate the railroads there in East Chicago, there'd be no East Chicago. The only reason East Chicago was there is because of the trains. On all four points of the compass in East Chicago and in Hammond and in Gary, there are trains. You spend a good three quarters of your life waiting for trains to go by there. And, of course, about every third or fourth night, you'd hear, kaboom! And you'd look out there and you'd see wheels and doors flying. Some guy was returning from Flick's Tavern with four of them under his belt, and he just met his maker. And his maker happened to be engine number 742 of the L&N, and that was the end of it. That's a pow. And night after night, I remember one day I'm standing. I'll tell you one of the most insane sights I've ever seen in my life. Now, people who live in an urban area of the New York area, now they see trains once in a while, but we live with trains the way the natives of Africa live with crocodiles. Oh, yes. The biggest thing that happened to people was to get hit by a train around there. There were always, almost every family had at least one or two people who had been killed by a train. In fact, three of my friends, of my boyhood friends from the time I was about 10 to about 18 or 19, three of my boyhood friends were killed in three separate train accidents. The commonest sight that you could see around there were men dragging themselves around on crutches, ex-brakemen. And who are now working as watchmen, you know, and crossing attendants. Oh, yeah, there was the trains killed more people, believe me, than the Crimean War. They were always walking around there, and old railroad men were always sitting out there with their wooden leg talking about the great days when they were working on the hump, and they exceeded all the production schedules, and all of these guys had the look of glory in their eye. Well, anyway, the story that I wanted to tell you about in connection with the trains and that world was this was a world, remember, of action. It was a world of coal cars. It was a world of steel mills, oil refineries. It was a world of pure, almost pure technology. And when people thought of education, what do you think they thought of? Engineering. Anybody who went to get an education went to Purdue. And what did he learn there? He learned metallurgy, or he learned electrical engineering, or he learned mechanical engineering. His whole idea was to come back and get a better deal in the mill. So it was a completely it was a non-intellectual world. And there was no real social class, but the classes that were classes of power in the mill. In short, when a guy got to be a big deal superintendent or something like that, he had another world. It was another world from the guys who were the yardbirds. But it was all the same world, remember. They all worked in the mill. They had all worked in the open hearth. They were all wrestling with the production schedules. Well, so you see the kind of world I came out of. And next thing I know, I'm in the Army. And my idea of things were usually related to physicality. You know, you do things by physical. You play football, for example. There was a very rare thing when a teenage kid did not play something frantically in the area that I lived in. You just did. Nobody hung back. Everybody played basketball or baseball or football. It was the most natural thing in the world. It was like walking or breathing. This is one of the reasons why so many big league ball players come from that section of the world. Oh, there's thousands. Moose Skowron is a typical example of a South Chicago belter. He looks exactly like every South Chicago softball player I ever saw. Big, chunky, square-jawed guy, Moose. walks around sort of stiff-legged and hits people. Well, Moosgowan is a typical example. Ted Klazuski. There's another one. Ted Klazuski. Oh, no, they're very good ball players. I would never argue with Klazuski. Well, this is the kind of a world you came out of. Now, what did the Army do? Let me tell you what the Army did. So we thought in terms of, you know, sports exciting. It's a physical thing. And every one of us played tennis. I used to play tennis from the crack of dawn till after dark. Probably 45 sets a day, doubles. We are always competing in the city, junior doubles. But the kind of tennis we played was, we never heard of a pro, you know. Nobody ever took lessons or any of that jazz. You just went out and belted, you learned really tough, like Pancho Segura, you know, the kind where you overhand smashes with both hands, you know, that kind. Pow! You belt that thing like hitting a line drive into left center field. And because I am a left-handed tennis player, I had a very sneaky advantage over most of the other people who were right-handed tennis players. Matter of fact, they used to say that it was cheating to play left-handed. It was just cheating. And I belt these things. It was great backhand shots. And we'd play all day long, running on the clay courts, all day long till we'd drop. The next day, we'd be out again. Then on Monday, we'd start with baseball. We'd play baseball all day long and then run home for supper and then unwind playing tennis for 2 hours. It was just the way the life was. And then on Tuesday, instead of baseball, you'd have a game on Tuesday, see, which was a night game. You would play tennis all day long. And then you would play, probably till 6 o'clock. You'd go home and grab a salami sandwich, couple of slugs of knee-high orange. Everybody would get in the cars and you'd put on your suit, your uniform to play the night game. You put on your suit, grab your glove, and you'd go to wherever you were playing the night game in the great big leagues around there. This was not Little League, nor was it American Legion. It was much tougher ball than that. This is what they call out there industrial ball. All kinds of strange ball players, ex-major leaguers and guys who go on. It's a very peculiar thing. Well, we used to go out every day, play the ball game, the night game, and then come back tennis all night. So that was you got the picture now, saying, okay. Well, all right, I'm in the Army now. And by a few odd quirks of the Army transportation system and classification, one thing another, I find myself in a completely different world. Palm Beach. Have you ever been in Palm Beach? Really in Palm Beach? Well, many people who are not in the upper classes, the peer class in America, just don't. If you do go to Palm Beach, all you can do is drive down Royal Palm Drive and along Lake Worth and look at it. You know, that's about it. You just don't get in. But being a GI during the war, there was a strange kind of a charitable opening of the doors to 6 guys a day, you know, bring home the poor GI for dinner, that kind of thing. Bring him home from the canteen. Now, on Palm Beach, there was a canteen, which I suspect among many soldiers will remain absolutely enshrined in their memory as something that you just can't forget it. It was more impressive than, in fact, the war or anything else itself. There was a canteen right on Palm Beach, right on Royal Palm Drive, that was operated by Palm Beach debutantes. Now, it was not connected with the USO. It was not connected with the Salvation Army. Oh, boy, not on Palm Beach. It was not connected with any charitable organization. It was called the V for Victory Canteen. As you can see, a very creative title. Now, it was anything but what it sounded like. You never saw such a she canteen. It's the only canteen I knew that they had done away completely with donuts, and they served hors d'oeuvres. You know, you get in there, there'd be a few little hors d'oeuvres. There would be a very mild punch for the younger GIs, and maybe one of the lesser years of a light still wine for the older ones, for those with a little more taste. They always kept in the background for just ordinary guys a couple of fat salami sandwiches, you know, for the guys that their eyes would water when they got the caviar, you know, that kind of stuff. Well, here I am, you know, I'm strictly a red cabbage type. I want to tell you that. I'm red cabbage. I'm strictly a going down to the chili parlor type. When I was going to have a real big night, I would go down to the Dog and Shake. And down at the Dog and Shake, I'd have a double king burger. A big double king burger with double Bermuda onion and relish and mustard and a little shot of mayonnaise, just a little touch of ketchup and some red pepper. And then I would sit there with a big slug of root beer and I would, you know, I'd just get fat. And just sit there. And that was my idea of superb eating. Well, I'm in this place. One thing I noticed about this joint, the GIs stayed away from it in droves. It's one of the few places that you really felt like a foreigner. Well, I'm in this camp about 2 or 3 days, and one of the guys says to me, he's going into Palm Beach, and I had never been into Palm Beach. I'm just in this place, and it's hot, and wow, it's insane. It's nothing at all like Hammond, Indiana. You can't believe what it looked like. And so we got on the bus. We went into town. We go over the bridge. You know, there's a bridge. Palm Beach is an island, you know. And we go over the bridge. We get out on Palm Beach, and it just indescribable, in my way of thinking it was. You know, those great royal palms. You ever seen those royal palms lining Royal Palm Drive just as far as you can see? And there was a sort of a flower-like atmosphere. You could see these great blossoms all over and these stucco homes in the background and these huge estates, that Meisner School of Palm Beach architecture, the little pots, you know, just sort of half Moorish, half neon sign, half South Chicago, a little touch of the Alhambra, a little bit of the Alamo, you know, very, very, and all pink and blue with cranes and stuff, and Rolls Royces quietly going past. Well, yeah, I look around here. No, not a train for miles around, nothing. They don't have any steel mills. They don't have any, they own the steel mills, that's true. But they haven't been nearer to the steel mills in 4,000 miles in years. Well, so the guy says, let's go into the canteen. Well, we go down to this canteen. And I just hope a couple of you who might be listening, ex-GIs who are listening, remember this canteen. Or we're in this canteen. It was a little one. It was the only canteen that I have ever seen that was modeled roughly on the general outlines of a very she-she Upper East Side bar. Because these people could not get out of their atmosphere. You know, they couldn't, they couldn't do it. And there were sort of chrome people walking around. It was kind of quiet. There was a little soft Haydn, you know, music, very good music being played in the background. They had a record player and things. And they had bottles all lined up around. These all lit from behind. And these magnificent bronzed debutante type girls. I had never seen girls like this. They just didn't live in Hammond. And these girls were all tawny. Do you know the expression tawny? That's a great expression. It describes a certain kind of moneyed person. They have a sort of high cheekbones and sunken cheeks. You know, that sort of thing. And yet at the same time, they look well fed. If you can look round and taut at the same time, they did. And their hair was all vaguely dark brown and honey colored all at the same time. And they all looked like They were wearing these soft kind of yellow things that tied around the middle, and their arms were bare and brown, and they moved kind of easy and lithe-like. You know that kind of movement? You see a lot of this, I guess, up in Westchester and so on. And they all looked like they vaguely had nothing on under what they were wearing, but at the same time, you knew that what they had on was infinitely exotic. You just knew it. You couldn't figure out what it was, but they just sort of moved, and they had sandals, and they were all gold and honey. And they were so nice. So nice, and it was the first time in my life I felt like a genuine beggar. It's that kind of niceness. You know the kind of niceness? There's a certain type of niceness that the real upper classes have toward the faithful servant class that seems to be so wonderful, but at the same time, oh boy. And I walked in there, and this girl says, would you like a drink? And she looks right at me with a kind of vague southern look. Would you like a drink? Where are you from, soldier? She looks at me. Is it no interest at all? I could just see there's nothing in the eye, you know, no interest at all. And what do you say? East Chicago. You know, you can't say that. So I just say nothing. You learn to say nothing. Well, I'm sort of hanging around this place, and I'm feeling lost. My friend has gone on somewhere. He knew a girl, and it's getting late. And GIs are very lonely people when they're in a new city, and they know nothing, and particularly when they're in a society that they don't understand. They just don't comprehend it. This was a mixture of New York money. It was a mixture of Southern gentility and old, old line tradition that goes way past, back, further than Robert E. Lee. You know, Robert E. Lee was that army man, the way they looked at it. Well, I didn't quite understand that I didn't belong, really. Well, in the middle of the afternoon, a car pulled up. It was my first genuine experience with a car thrill. It was a low, red, wire-wheeled, open automobile of the kind I have never seen in my life. I lived in a world of Model A's, Ed, you know, and 38 Pontiacs. I lived in a world of big, used clunkers and stuff. Well, this thing came up, and it sat out there, and it was fire engine red. It has these pipes coming out the side, and sort of a big, flat, double tire in the back. I never saw anything. I look out at this. And it pulled up, and who gets out but the tawniest of all the creatures? And she is with a very wasp-waisted young man with a knit T-shirt that must have cost $40 an inch. That kind of shirt, you know, woven out of pure cashmere hair from the belly only. You know, that kind of thing. He gets out, bronze, square-jawed, curly-haired, and 4F. He gets out, and very, very rich. This guy gets out, and I'm looking out, and I'm with a couple of other GIs, you know, just sort of sitting there eating the caviar sandwiches, is what we called, you know, the fish sandwich we're eating. And they're bringing us that stuff that bubbled. And we're looking out, and this car pulls up, and this woman comes in, and she is just tawny, and she is wearing a bright yellow kind of a Roman gown. It's sort of all flowing, you know, it's with pleats, but very short and long at the same time. And everything she had was amplified theatrically. Everything. It was just fantastic. She comes out, long hair flowing behind her. She says, "Oh, my darlings. Oh, you wonderful, wonderful soldiers. Come and sit at my table." It was Tallulah. Well, now, to me, you know, at that time in my life, the name of Tallulah Bankhead was such a remote, far well, it was just one of those names, you know, like Franklin Roosevelt, you know, like Clark Gable and Rosalind Russell. These are people that are just names that you see on signs. Well, here she's, "Oh, my darlings, just come and sit at my table. Come, all of you, come on. And she takes all of us, and we sit around the table, and we're immediately, you know, we're feeling very funny. We sort of sit there, and she says, "Oh, aren't you just wonderful? Now, which one of you wants to go with me today?" And she looks around, and there were three of us. One short, fat guy from Tennessee with glasses. A tall, thin guy from Alberta, someplace up in a Canadian army, and me. Well, I've got a look in the eye. I don't know what it is about people always pick me. I've never told you this story, have I? My afternoon with Tallow. Oh, for crying out. I bet she doesn't even remember it. I'll lay you 10-1. She doesn't, because she didn't remember it even then. You know, it's that kind of, "Oh, come on, get into the car. Ricky, here, you stay here, Ricky. We'll be back." You know, this sort of thing. Well, Ricky is a little bug. You know, Ricky's walking around. He says, "Come on, let's go, Tallulah. Please, come on. I don't have time. Mums is waiting, you know." And he's walking around in the back, and you could just see those cream-colored slacks swishing around. And he says, "Oh, come on. Let's go, Tallow. Mums is waiting." And he's sort of square. And she says, "Oh, Ricky, will you please shut up?" Well, I don't recognize this kind of world, you see, at all. It's just, this is not at all the Cold Strip. It certainly isn't Hammond High. And finally, Tallow says to me, she says, "Oh, come on, darling, you're coming with me." And we get out into this car, and she sits down, and it's the first time I have ever seen a two-seater sports automobile of rare vintage. For those of you who are followers of cars, it was a mint condition SS100 Jaguar. The SS standing for Super Sports 100, 100 mile an hour. They in those days, it was built about the mid or late 30s. It was magnificent, flame red, had those beautiful brand new black Michelin tires on the side there, and those lovely chrome spoke wheels. And we got in there, that big wooden dashboard with aluminum insert. And Tallow sits on her side, which is a right-hand drive car, and she says, "Come on, we're going to the club. You like tennis?" Oh, yeah. We go, and I'm hanging on. I'm riding down Royal Palm Drive with Tallulah Bankhead. You know, this is insane. Her hair is flying, and she's meeting all these people on the street, you know. "Oh, my darling!" And she turns around, and the car's going up on the hill and down. Bobby! And we're going along. She's just waving at the trees and waving at the squirrels and waving at the ocean. They were all old friends, you know. Waves at the sun, the whole business. And we finally arrive at a place called the Palm Beach Tennis Club. Well, I can only tell you that the Palm Beach Tennis Club is what it sounds like, only in spades. It goes even further than that. It is not really tennis they have there. It's a mystique. I found that out. Of course, I expect to see tennis. I'm thinking of me and Schwartz putting the ball around, you know. And it seemed that on this day, they were having an elimination, one of the eliminations that go on around the country, one of the seeding eliminations for the Davis Cup. And that's why, apparently Ricky was going to go with Tallow. Tallow saw this lumpin' proletariat there, and she figured she'd take him to the tennis. Well, we arrive, and of course Tallow has a box. Not only, well, it's, I'll tell you where it was. It was just a little bit to the left of the center line. It was right behind the net. It was, in fact, right behind, it was right over the guy. It was very difficult to describe. If you can get a box in the middle of the court, she had one. You know, the ball's flying right past you and that kind of thing. Well, we're sitting there, we came in, and there's all these people. And it's just before the matches are about to begin, and all the very rich people. Now, that's spelled in capital letter. This is very rich because it's a separate race. I go along with F. Scott Fitzgerald, and I do not go along with Hemingway, who I for a long time have suspected is a totally insensitive clod. I believe this. When Fitzgerald said the rich are different from you and me, he meant it. He meant it. Now I suspect that what Hemingway was always thinking about was big, rich, used car dealers. Oh, no, Fitzgerald was talking about something else, I'll tell you. And you find it there at the Palm Beach Tennis Club, Ed. And here I am. I'm a GI from Hammond, Indiana. Well, they have these green seats, and everything is kind of green. And they have little walls all around it. And absolutely, this place, like all very rich places, is totally removed from the rest of the world. Because even the sun, you understand, is a lumpen proletariat. Everybody has the sun. There's a certain snobbery. Oh, yes, the certain snobbery, even about the sky. They don't like the sky because, you know, that's everybody. This is anybody can have the sky. And so I'm brought in there, and we're kind of sitting in the upper deck, and there are little boxes, and people are all in little clumps. I had never been to a sporting event where people are sort of in little clumps, and they all know each other. Absolutely everybody. Oh, Harry, this is, what did you say your name was? Jean Shepard. He's so wonderful. An old friend of mine, you know. He's in the theater. You know, I'm sitting there and nodding. And she couldn't say that, you know, he's just this lump that I got from the canteen. And so I'm sitting there, and I don't know. I'm saying nothing. It's one of the rare afternoons I do not open my mouth all afternoon. I just go, I nod a little bit, and I say, "Yes, ma'am." When she says, "Would you like a drink? What would you like? I particularly enjoy the Benedictine here." And yes. And so they bring me some of this stuff, and it makes my nose burn and everything. Well, I'm sitting watching the tennis match, and here's the way it went. Oh, Oh, very, very, very good, very good. Well, it was so different. I didn't know quite what to do. It was very different than these men who were playing tennis did not look like Schwartz. Not at all. They were all very tall, skinny guys with white shorts. We were all short guys with black overalls. It was a very different kind of tennis, you know. These guys were tall, thin, bronzed men, and for some reason or other, half of the guys they were playing were very old men, but the skinny old kind, you know, that you see in the Hiram Walker ads. You know, the kind of guys with the white, wavy hair, Ed, and they're with a 12-year-old girl who's tawny, and they're leaving for the Bahamas with her. You know, the kind that you see always in the Thunderbird and that. Well, these guys are out playing tennis, and they all have the white shorts and the white shirts. Everything is so fantastically spotless. And the whole place is filled with people wearing Palm Beach, you know, the little suits and things. And in the middle of it all is one guy in this GI suit, me. Well, all afternoon, I sit. I watch this, and it's hard for me, anyway, to describe incomprehension. I did not comprehend it. I didn't comprehend. I knew what they were playing. I knew it was tennis. But I couldn't feel. Have you ever been totally out of your element where you don't understand what's going on really, and you're afraid to do something that's just impossible, just terrible? And all the while, Talu kept reaching over and putting her arm on my. She reached over and grabbed my arm. Said, "Oh, wasn't that good? Wasn't that a wonderful shot? Isn't that? Oh, Freddie." The man who was playing was a man named Fred Perry, I believe. "Oh, Fred, Freddie! Oh, very good, Freddie, good, good." Well, we're sitting there all afternoon. And finally, it is getting dark, the tennis matches are over, and we wander out, and apparently suddenly Tallulah Bankhead realized that here was a GI, and she was Tallulah Bankhead, and she said, "Well, I suppose you'll want to get back to your friends now. Hasn't it been a wonderful afternoon?" Get into the SS-100, and she waves at all the people. Of course, she was a big celebrity there, naturally. And they were all wondering, who was this one? Who was this one? I was wondering at that point, who was this one? By now, I was like, "Wow!" We go back, and we arrive in front of the canteen, and there's the Canadian soldier in there, itching. The Canadians have very hot summer uniforms. And there was my short, fat friend with the glasses from Tennessee. They're both still looking out of there, both still drinking the weak punch. We arrive, and she says, "It's been wonderful, a wonderful afternoon, darling." And I say, "Yes, it has. Thank you very much, ma'am." And she gets into her car. Last time I ever saw a Tallulah Bankhead. I walk into the canteen, and here's this short, fat guy named Simon. He looks up at me, and he says, "What'd you do? What'd you do this afternoon? Boy, that was some chick, man. Did you score?" And I said, "What?" And he says, "Yeah, real, that was a real chick, man." And the Canadian says, "Very interesting girl. Very interesting girl. Who was she?" As well as Tallulah Bankhead, you know. Tallulah Bankhead. They had never heard of her. They just sat there and says, "Tallulah Bankhead. Who's Tallulah Bankhead? Huh?" And this kid, Simon, kept saying, "What'd you do?"
This is WOR Radio, your